Governor Kristi Noem deploys National Guard members with money from a private donor. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Thursday, July 1st. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we gather a roundtable of historians and political scientists to unpack the legalities and appropriateness of Governor Noem's announcement. Shane Nordyke, Kurt Hackamer, and Tim Shorn are with us. We examine the mental health toll of the pandemic and what kinds of conversations about suicide prevention are effective. Then a stressed plant can quickly turn to a sick plant, kind of like a person. Eric Helland is with us today for South Dakota Home Garden. Plus, the Black Hills Blues Society brings Indigenous to the stage. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio in SDPB's Sioux Falls studio. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
And with SDPB News, I'm Kyle Ireland. The South Dakota Highway Patrol is adjusting its approach to marijuana. The patrol says people can possess up to 3 ounces of marijuana if they can prove it's for medical reasons. The voter-approved ballot measure legalizing medical marijuana becomes law today. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
The Highway Patrol says if people are unable to produce a doctor's note or a medical card, they could be charged with a crime. The state health department says it might not be ready to issue medical cards until October. Meanwhile, some state's attorney's offices are holding off on charging individuals for possessing small amounts of marijuana. Mark Vargo is the Pennington County State's Attorney. His office is joining at least 2 other counties that won't default to charging people with possession.
Under 3 ounces, we're going to have very little to do with that. On the other hand, if an officer believed that that was, again, clearly not medicinal for whatever reason, like I don't know exactly how they would prove that, but if they did, they might still bring us that case and we would look at it.
The medical marijuana law does not allow driving under the influence or smoking in a vehicle. People also aren't allowed to use marijuana in public. Vargo says those are separate offenses from actual possession.
The narrative of the rules have all disappeared is not quite true, but we have to be smart about putting our effort and our time into the most important things.
South Dakota voters also approved recreational marijuana in November, but a lawsuit has that law on hold. The state Supreme Court is expected to rule on that case soon. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
The Biden administration has new strategies to handle gun violence and increase public safety. And Rapid City is part of an initiative to support community violence intervention. Steve Allender is the city's mayor. He's talking with federal leaders about Rapid City's tactics to handle crime. He says the city is participating because of its response to crime and public safety.
Based on our approach to violent crime and homelessness and community interaction, we've been really building up a new way of doing things over the last couple of years. I believe we've gotten some recognition.
The city is beginning to send community liaisons to neighborhood shootings. Allender says they may start using social workers in response teams when police are called to a situation without a specific crime. Rapid City is one of more than a dozen jurisdictions involved in this collaboration. A federal judge in South Dakota who charged 3 members of the U.S. Marshals Service with contempt of court over a COVID-19 vaccination dispute has removed himself from the case after assigning an in-state attorney to prosecute. The chain of events began when state and federal prosecutors declined to handle the case. A retired attorney whom Judge Charles Kornman tried to appoint opted out over debate on whether he needed to restart his practice. Kornman then assigned Thomas Fritz of Rapid City. 3 supervisory marshals are accused of allowing a deputy marshal to leave the courthouse in Aberdeen after refusing to tell the judge whether she had been vaccinated against COVID-19. And in today's weather, we have sunny skies and heat across the board, with gusting wind conditions in the west potentially reaching as high as 22 miles an hour. We're expecting calmer winds in the east. We have highs in the 90s across the state, with lows down in the 60s going into the evening. To access our stories, visit our website at sdpb.org/news. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Kyle Ireland.
And I'm Lori Walsh. More than 63% of the state is experiencing severe drought conditions. Laura Edwards is the SDSU state climatologist, and she joins us now from the Tom and Danielle Ammon Foundation Studio on the campus of Northern State University in Aberdeen. Laura, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you.
All right, the last time you joined us, we talked about the current drought conditions with some comparisons to the Dust Bowl era. How are conditions shaping up now?
Yeah, certainly things are getting worse as we look at the drought situation today. And looking at the month of June overall, we have a handful of stations that have recorded their driest June on record. Some of these records go back to the 1890s, 1870s. In the case of McPherson County, and they come all the way down to Brule County, Charles Mix County. We're seeing record dry Junes all across the eastern part of the state. We've also seen very warm temperatures not as many records there as 1988 and 1933 really hold the records across the state for warmest Junes, but we've had several days in the 90s, 100s. So drought is really, really taking a firm hold on the state right now.
What are some of the things when we look back at some of those times in history where we all think of what we know about the Dust Bowl? What's different now than times in different years? Are there comparisons that are useful here?
Yeah, I think when we look at historical drought in South Dakota, things that make it much worse are very warm temperatures. You know, we get dry periods quite a bit. We have a lot of variability here in the Northern Plains. But when you add this very, very hot temperatures, that makes things really that much worse. You look in the agriculture side, you know, there's been, you know, decades and decades of stories and history telling us that our farming practices today are a lot better than what we had in the 1930s, but still that doesn't mean agriculture is unaffected, and we're seeing now very large losses in grass and hay, and now I've heard stories of people cutting wheat for hay instead of growing it for grain, harvesting for grain, same with oats. So we're starting to see some very significant impacts in several industries and economies across the state.
Yeah, farmers are already pulling ditch hay. I've heard a couple talk about that, selling cattle early. There's quite an impact to the drought other than just how it feels when you walk outside, for sure, and an economic impact as well.
That's right. And water supply is another thing. I think we're right on the cusp of seeing some more water restrictions at a lot of areas around the state as the Missouri River continues to fall in its levels as well.
Yeah. All right. Our outlook for July, not much better, or are we hoping for some improvement?
You know, it's really not optimistic, unfortunately. And also my colleague, the state fire meteorologist, Dr. Darren Klebo, He also came out with his fire outlook this morning, and fire danger is very high to high all across the state. The outlook for July, continued warm and dry conditions, and certainly that's going to be true the next couple of weeks as we see near record high temperatures continuing well into July. So really, I don't think we can overstate how severe extreme the conditions are right now, and they're going to be holding strong through the next month.
All right, so just a quick tip for people thinking about fireworks displays or backyard fireworks, that those conditions really across the entire state are, very high risk right now. Can you tell me, Laura, as we've talked before in this program about the climate science and how things are changing in our region and around the 100th Meridian, for example, are we pushing into extremes here because climate is changing, or how does this all connect and intersect?
Yeah, I think this is consistent with what we know about a changing climate here in the Northern Plains, where we can get some very big swings and extremes. Thinking 2 years ago from 2019, we had record wet conditions, and now we're in very dry conditions. We've seen this not too long in history. You know, 2011 was very wet, 2012 very dry. So I think these big swings and extremes are really kind kind of a story that we're going to be living here for a while. You know, we do have a long-term trend of wetter and warmer conditions in South Dakota in general, but we can still see these big drops in precipitation.
Yeah. Any high-impact heat events coming our way, like we have seen in the northwest of the U.S., that could really also make a big difference here?
You know, I think it's been in the forecast, for this weekend, you know, and we're going to see this kind of hold true for another week and a half or so.
Laura Edwards, SDSU Extension State Climatologist, thank you so much for helping us follow this really important and impactful story. We appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you, Lori.
Experts have predicted a tsunami of psychiatric illness in the aftermath of COVID-19. We're going to talk about suicide prevention after the break. What kinds of conversations make the situation better, not worse? You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
In the summer of 1969, hundreds of thousands of people gathered for a music festival. No, not in Woodstock, but in Harlem.
I was amazed at the diversity of it. This is a concert festival that somehow found space for every type of genre, from Africa to Harlem.
I'm Elsa Chang, the Summer of Soul, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, on SDPB.
Program funding by the Sanford Underground Research Facility. Supporting public outreach through its free science festival, Neutrino Day, Star Chronicles. Join the fun in our virtual science town July 9th through the 10th. More at neutrinoday.com and sanfordlab.org.
I am pleased to announce that SDPB has been awarded 9 Regional Edward R. Murrow Awards for our reporting in 2020. Winning categories include writing, video, features, sports, investigative reporting, continuing coverage, and the Overall Excellence Award. Your support makes it possible. Thank you for your partnership as we tell South Dakota stories. Award-winning reporting is what you have come to expect and what we continue to strive for at SDPB.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. Every big endeavor begins somewhere, with someone who has a dream and the passion to make it happen first. FirstDakota.com/first.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. In 2020, 184 people died by suicide in South Dakota. For every completed death by suicide, experts say there are 25 attempts. Bridget Swear is the Director of Communications and Outreach at the Front Porch Coalition in Rapid City. She's joining me now from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio inside SDPB's Black Hills studio. Bridget, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
There were many predictions as we went through the pandemic, the height of it so far, at least I should say, that the mental health toll, depression, anxiety, addiction, variety of mental illnesses that went untreated or undiagnosed, we were going to see an epidemic of increases in mental illness and mental health and stress on people. In your experience, has that, at least anecdotally, been true? Have you seen the results of pandemic stress in people's lives?
Absolutely. I think that it's, there's already a shortage of providers in South Dakota, and especially in our rural populations. And then when we have a pandemic or a natural disaster, there is increased stressors that come with that. And so trying to seek mental health services during the pandemic was very, very challenging. Experts are also saying that typically when some sort of situation like a pandemic or natural disaster happens, that we see community gather and really come together and they lean on each other. And so typically what they say is that those numbers might decrease during a pandemic, but actually within 2 years, they can potentially spike. So I don't even think that we've seen the tip of what we're going to be dealing with as far as mental health quite yet.
Yeah. So every time we do a story like this, I like to say my cousin's name, Joe Hall, who died by suicide. I can't really even tell you the year that he died. It's been a while now. But the ripple effects of that on everyone's lives still resonate. What can you tell us about, you know, one event, one loss of life, and how many people it really does impact, and for how long?
So they say that on average, when there's one loss of life to suicide, that 110 to 115 people are impacted. That there could be more and there might be a little bit less. But you have to remember that this person was part of our community. Maybe they had a church community. They have family. They have a work community. They have hobby communities. And so the ripple effects are very, very far-reaching. So I think that it impacts far more people than what some might realize. And as far as speaking to how long those effects, I think it's lifelong. I mean, you mm-hmm. still, you know, you speak your cousin's name every time. You've never forgotten. Yeah. And so, you know, I think those losses are something that people carry with them for their lifetime.
Are conversations like what we're having right now good and healthy for people? Because the cliche has always been, don't talk about this. It will give people ideas. Let's talk about how to talk about this in ways that are healthy and effective. What tips do you have?
Absolutely. So it is actually a misconception that talking about suicide leads to more deaths by suicide. And unfortunately, if someone is struggling with a mental health challenge and they're having thoughts of suicide, those thoughts are already there. You're not placing them in someone's head by having the conversation. I do think it's important that we're mindful of how we speak about it. One, it has to be a conversation that we have. Two, the language that we use surrounding it is so important. Oftentimes people will say, well, so-and-so committed suicide. When you think of committed, we think of criminals, criminal activity, illegal behavior. People with mental health challenges are not committing crimes. And so to take that stigma away is very important. Instead, we like to use the terms they've died by suicide. It's far more compassionate, especially to people who are survivors and still living in the aftermath of losing a loved one. It's far more compassionate for them. And so changing the language in that aspect is very simple. And something that everybody can practice. It does take mindfulness to be aware of it. But then, you know, saying that a suicide was successful, that has the attachment of achievement and success to it. And that is not the message that we want to be sending. Mm-hmm. So instead, we encourage the language of a completed suicide. And again, that's far more compassionate. It's empathetic to the families who have experienced that loss. And it doesn't attach that achievement.
Or failure.
For failure.
For people who have ongoing battles with suicidal ideations or suicidal actions or major depressive issues, the whole sense that, you know, there was a moment in your life where you were in this place and then you failed to complete an act is always hanging over. And there's a lot of people who have those suicidal ideations and who struggle with it on an ongoing basis. I want to ask you this before we run out of time, because this is really important. You know, you mentioned rural South Dakotans. How do communities, small towns, rural communities, what are your suggestions for creating open dialogues around mental illness and suicide? Because that can be a really hard thing to do when everybody knows you and is always going to remember that, you know, you're the person who talked about this or this was in your family. What are some things that communities, smaller communities, rural communities can do?
I think you can do that on a micro or macro level. Get a town hall meeting. Talk about mental health. Talk about the resources that are available. Talk about it on your front porch when you're having some sun tea or coffee with your neighbor. That's actually how we established our name, is that survivors of suicide were coming together and talking on the front porch of a survivor's house, and it just kept growing and growing. Having those conversations at any and every opportunity to let people know that you're a safe person to come to, that you're not going to be critical, judgmental, you're not going to ostracize them. I think in small communities, if we, you know, there's kind of that hush whispering that's going on when there is a tragedy like this. And also, you know, if we see so-and-so's vehicle down at the mental health clinic. Mm-hmm. And those really perpetuate stigma and prevent people who are struggling from wanting to deal with that when they're already struggling and having a difficult enough time. And so let's be an embracing community where it's okay to say, I'm having a tough time. I need some help. We really need to embrace that mindset.
Yeah. Bridget Swear is a director of communications and outreach at the Front Porch Coalition in Rapid City. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you next time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ahead on the program, what happens when a governor partners with a private donor for national security without the green light from the federal government? We talk about Governor Noem and the South Dakota National Guard. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, the New York Times' Adam Goldman reports on an undercover effort by conservatives to infiltrate progressive groups, political campaigns, and the offices of Democratic and moderate Republican elected officials. At the heart of the operation were a former British spy and security contractor Eric Prince, an avid supporter of Donald Trump. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by the Sanford Underground Research Facility. Supporting public outreach through its free science festival, Neutrino Day, Star Chronicles. Join the fun in our virtual science town July 9th through the 10th. More at neutrinoday.com and sanfordlab.org.
I'm Julie Rose. Join me for a special episode of Top of Mind marking Independence Day. A vexillologist, that's a flag expert, explains why so many countries use the colors red, white, and blue. And we'll consider how Americans have always used the Constitution to justify competing visions of what America stands for. It's Top of Mind.
Monday, July 5th at noon Central and again at 7 Central on SDPB Radio.
Program funding with your support and by McCrory Gardens in Brookings, planting over 40,000 flowers every spring. More information at McCroryGardens.com. McCrory Gardens, ready to bloom.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Governor Kristi Noem says she will deploy as many as 50 members of South Dakota's National Guard to Texas to help secure the border with Mexico. Today, we're exploring the legality, the history, and the ethics of that decision. We've gathered scholars from the University of South Dakota for the conversation. Joining me now in the SDPB Sioux Falls studio, we have Professor Kurt Hackamer. He's Provost and Vice President of Academic Affairs. He teaches a wide range of American military history courses, among other offerings. Kurt Hackamer, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Lori.
Joining us from the SDPB studios in Vermilion, we have Shane Nordyke, Director of the USD Government Research Bureau and Associate Professor in the Political Science Department. Shane Nordyke teaches national security policy, among others. Dr. Nordyke, welcome.
Happy to be here.
Also joining us from Vermilion, we welcome Tim Shorn. He's Director for USD's International Studies and an Associate Professor in the Political Science Department. He's also a retired member of the South Dakota National Guard. Welcome as well.
Thanks. I'm happy to be back.
All right. I want to start with Shane Nordyke at first. And help us understand some of the nuances of just this big picture of state governors partnering with private donors to engage in national security issues and the limitations of that. So where do you want to begin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's maybe helpful to start with what's not unusual about this case. And okay. So it's not unusual for states to deploy their own National Guard. So when they're not called up to federal action, the governors actually serve as the commander-in-chief of the National Guard units within their state, and they'll regularly call them up to help to respond to natural disasters or other incidents. It's also not uncommon for states to deploy their National Guard units to other states. It's commonly done under some sort of Emergency Management Assistance Compact. Usually when that happens, the other state has an agreement to, you know, kind of pay back that state for the services that are offered or for the costs that are incurred. And so we do that pretty regularly. It's also not uncommon for the National Guard units to be called in to help with border control. And so since the George W. Bush administration and the Obama administration, the Trump administration, we've had lots of National Guard troops that have been down on the Mexico border helping U.S. Customs and Border Protection. And so all of those pieces aren't unusual. I think that the unusual piece in this case is having the private funding. Typically, if a state is going to call up its National Guards units, that would be paid for by the state's budget, and that would be paid for out of state funds, unless it was called up at the federal level, in which case the federal government would then cover the payment for those. Or we usually have the other state that we're, you know, lending those National Guard troops to that would pay back the state for the use of those forces. And so this is really an unusual case in where you have a private donor saying, I will provide the funding to be able to do this, but the deployment of National Guard for border protection or the lending of National Guard units to another state that needs them during a time of crisis, that's all pretty normal.
All right, Kurt Hackamore. Unprecedented is one of these words that we all struggle with, especially as it's been overused so much. So give us a historical perspective. Is this something that's been done before throughout American history?
It has been done before, Lori, not since the 19th century. So at the last quarter of the 19th century, the United States was racked by a series of violent strikes. Where National Guard units were called out operating against strikers.
And labor unions. Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And in the wake of those strikes, the worst of them happened in Pennsylvania and Illinois. And in the wake of those strikes, then those two states especially formed these interesting public-private partnerships with their National Guard units and local businessmen, local industrialists. Hmm. And so you see organizations like the Chicago Civil Association, which is supporting three regiments of the Illinois National Guard, is supplementing their budget because they want the protection for their industrial base. Pennsylvania has the reputation of having the most effective National Guard in the 1880s and 1890s for the same reason. They're supported by private money throughout. The caveat there, of course, is that's 19th century. And as Dr. Nordyke mentioned, the rules have changed quite a bit. And so historians draw a distinction between what happens before 1903, which is a major reform moment for the National Guard, and after 1903. But before 1903, there's actually precedent for this.
Does something change that in 1903? Why is that the demarcation line, if you will?
What 1903 does through the passage of a piece of legislation called the Dick Act is it changes the relationship between the National Guard and the federal government, and it changes the way that the National Guard is funded and budgeted and the kinds of support it receives from the federal government. So when there's more federal dollars that come into play in the 20th century, then the need for these private funds decreases.
All right, so I guess the big question is, can anyone in this space right now say whether this is a violation of the Dick Act? Is this, has so much changed that this is illegal or a violation of that?
I don't think so. The Dick Act does not specifically outlaw private funds. It just sets up a new funding structure for the Guard.
Got it. Tim Shorn, you're also a retired member of the National Guard, and I was active duty, and I remember this time where during Operation Desert Shield and Storm, where there was just a whole national rethinking of how the National Guard was supposed to operate with some of those deployments. Give us a National Guard woven with a political science perspective about, are we looking at another massive shift about how the Guard can be, should be, or can't be used?
I think that's a good question. And you're right to bring up Desert Storm, Desert Shield, going back to 1990, that we really did see a change in how the National Guard would be deployed. And it became the accepted wisdom that the United States cannot go to war without the Guard. And that's an incredible sea change from the era of the Vietnam War. So I think the first major change, or the most recent major change, is that when it comes to national security, the National Guard is absolutely necessary. I would be hesitant to say, though, what is occurring right now with the 50 members of the South Dakota National Guard. I would be hesitant to say that that represents a new change. I would see this as more of an anomaly, as an aberration. That what it has done, though, is really started to move the conversation forward about how do we fund the Guard at the state level. I think that's something that our South Dakota legislators are really going to be looking at, because this is not something that they discussed and debated. This is not something that they voted on to support this particular mission. That what this looks like is an end run by the governor around the usual appropriations process to achieve something that might have not been approved otherwise. This does start to, I think, raise questions, probably in the minds of some military leaders, about what type of missions could be on the horizon if, in fact, the legislature does not serve as a check on this type of action by not just perhaps our governor, but other governors down the road. And certainly, I think it's going to raise some questions in the minds of individual guardsmen and women about what their oath ultimately meant. They take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, and in the case of South Dakota National Guardsmen and Women South Dakota. But I have a feeling that there's some concern in the minds of many about making themselves available to what is essentially a private donor wanting to move forward on a particular political issue. So I think there's going to be a lot of discussions in the future, and that's one of the things that this particular action by the governor has started.
Yeah. Shane, I talked to several lawmakers on background after this original announcement came from the governor's office about the private donation, and they were anywhere from perplexed to frustrated to alarmed as they tried to figure out exactly what to do next, like what was going to happen next. From a national security issue, as you teach national security policy, what changes with something like this? You know, is this a state issue? Is this a national issue? Does the president respond to this kind of conversation? What do you foresee happening in the days ahead as far as the debate is concerned?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think there's, you know, multiple layers of sort of us considering what we need to do next as we think about this. You know, when it comes to a state deciding to activate their state National Guard, that is governed by that state's constitution and laws that they have in place. So what rules are in place for South Dakota might be different than what the rules are in another state about when and how they can activate their National Guard, or how it is that they might pay for those and what that's going to look like. So that's certainly something that the South Dakota legislature may want to take up and to reconsider as they're opening this question of, you know, maybe we need to relook and think about this if this isn't something that they want to happen, or if they do feel that this is an okay use of those guards, like how do we better kind of facilitate and create some rules for that in order to, you know, normalize that and create a process there. I mean, there is the opportunity for a federal response, and we do see, you know, the Senate Armed Forces Committee sort of thinking about what this looks like and what this means, and you certainly could have the federal government federally activate South Dakota's National Guard in order to, it's kind of an end run around, but that would be a really big step for them to take. And so I think, instead you'll probably see other types of regulations. Another question to ask here is that, you know, as they're starting to be a little bit more creative about these deployments, is also to consider the chain of command issue. So typically when you have a state that is lending its National Guard to another state through an emergency management assistant compact, they fall under the chain of command within that state. So they would fall under the governor's command within the state of Texas, or if it's been federally activated, then there's a separate federal chain of command that they would fall under there. If you have multiple people responding and sort of sending to the border all under different chains of command, that can create a really, you know, a problematic situation where accountability becomes difficult and it's hard to have everybody working in the same concerted way. And so I think that this question that brought everybody, kind of caught everybody by surprise, will probably result in lots of further conversations about how we need to think about this going forward.
Dr. Hackamer, chain of command issues. This is a very storied National Guard. The South Dakota National Guard has a very rich history. Tell us what that sort of comment from Shane makes you sort of think of when it comes to, you know, that big picture of the South Dakota National Guard.
No, Shane's absolutely right in the sense of the issues with integrating the chains of command. What actually came to my mind more from thinking about it from a command perspective is thinking about what this does, potential impacts on things like training and readiness. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where the 50 guardsmen are coming from. If they're being pulled from different units that are training up for different missions, then you disrupt things like training cycles. If I'm the leadership of the South Dakota National Guard, that's something that I want to think about. What impact does this have, not on just on the particular mission that the Guard has been tasked to do right now, but what's the potential impact on other missions that the Guard is preparing for? I mean, it takes time to train a unit up, right?
Right.
And so what happens when you disrupt that?
Yeah, and where does it end? Tim Shorn, anything you wanted to add to that?
Well, and I think one of the bigger issues that we need to consider as well is the kind of civil-military divide. This has really politicized, whether intended or not, the South Dakota Army National Guard. So what happens now when it comes to recruiting? There are going to be many Guards members and families and potential Guard members who are going to look at this particular action and have real grave doubts. There are going to be others who say, this is something I can get behind and it's something that I'm willing to volunteer for. This starts to create a kind of a political divide, both within the Guard and also in the civil-military relationship. And this is something that is hard to undo in the short term. And I think it's something that we need to consider in the long run, that we don't want to start creating divisions in either in the Guard or in the South Dakota community. There was one thing I just wanted to comment on. Shane mentioned the Biden administration could certainly federalize the South Dakota National Guard to prevent something like this from happening. And we have seen that before during the Civil Rights era, where the administrations federalized National Guards of particular southern states so that governors couldn't use them to protect segregation. And I don't think we've reached that point yet, but it will be interesting to see how this develops over the next couple of years as part of a partisan battle between Republican governors and a Democratic president, and also as governors and others start to prepare themselves for other campaigns. So this could really see the National Guard being used as a partisan tool, and over-politicized, and I think that's one of the largest dangers that we're seeing come out of this particular incident.
Mm-hmm. We are going to leave it there for now. More to talk about in the future. We've had Professors Tim Shorn, Shane Nordyke, and Kurt Hackamer with us. Thank you, all of you, for helping us think this through and put it into perspective for the questions we need to ask ahead. Thanks.
Thank you, Lori.
Thank you.
Let's take a moment now to consider the pressures of drought, climate, and the markets on South Dakota's cattle ranchers. Justin Tupper is vice president of the United States Cattlemen's Association. He testified before the U.S. Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry recently. Tupper's opening remarks before the committee, chaired by Senator Debbie Stabenow of Michigan, pointed to the plight of Midwest cattle producers who are struggling to get fair prices. Tupper is from St. Ange, South Dakota. Before his opening remarks, he was encouraged by fellow South Dakotan U.S. Senator John Thune to demonstrate his talent as an auctioneer. Here's Justin Tupper.
Well, sure. Thank you, Senator Thune. And with that, I don't know that we could get him in this room, but if we had a fat steer, we'd ask $1.20. And now one. And anybody get 21, two. And anybody get 2, 3, 4. And anybody get 4, 5. And hope we get to $2. That's where we're trying to head. So thank you, Senator Thune.
I love it.
I'm privileged to be here representing cattle producers and independent meat processors across the U.S. This hearing is critical because there is a crisis in rural America. We are losing our producers at an alarming rate, all the while watching big corporate feeders, packers make record profits with the threat of vertical integration hanging over our head. As cattle producers, we are natural stewards of the land. These family farms, ranchers work day in, day out to produce a high-quality protein product in a safe and sustainable way. As we sit here today, producers in my state and across the country are enduring devastating drought conditions. This is just one of the many challenges cattle producers face year in and year out. all the while managing the land, borrowing money to keep the operation running, fighting drastic shifts in weather, and dealing with the rising input costs and a fallen bottom line. Most ranchers who sell their calves at weaning time are selling those calves for less than $1,000 a head. That's somewhere near $100 a head profit after all input costs and amounts to less than a 1% return on investment, an incredible risky business. For those who raise and sell all the way to fat cattle, calving to finish, a finished steer is worth somewhere around $1,600 a head today. Packers could buy that steer, process it, and sell it for beef alone, not counting byproducts, for over $2,800 a head today for a gross margin profit of over 80%. We as cattle producers understand and want the packer to make money. That makes the whole system work. But since 2015, corporate packers' gross margin has ballooned from an average of $100 to $200 a head to well over $1,000 a head. American cattle producers don't want, nor are we looking for, a handout. We just want a fair and equitable playing field, staffed by a referee with a whistle and a flag.
That's South Dakota's Justin Topper, Vice President of the United States Cattlemen's Association. Coming up on the program, a stressed plant can be a sick plant, kind of like people. We talk with Eric Helland for this week's South Dakota Home Garden. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Peter O'Dowd, our music opinionator Fran Hoffner has picked some music that she says captures the excitement of returning to the world again after the pandemic. We'll dive into Aguas de Amazonia by Philip Glass next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by the South Dakota Humanities Council. Presenting this year's One Book South Dakota, The Children's Blizzard by Melanie Benjamin. Learn more about her virtual author tour and in-person Festival of Books appearance at sdhumanities.org.
Thank you to those that gave to SDPB during the Sound Vision Campaign Radio Drive. Your gift will help create events, tell stories, and build community. You play a part in guaranteeing that SDPB serves the state for years to come. There's still time to give. The more people that come together to support SDPB, the more SDPB can do. Give at sdpb.org/donate.
Healthcare is not only a matter of personal care, but also a major public policy issue. SDPB covers all angles of public health practices and procedures, from illness to recovery. The healthcare beat on SDPB is supported by Monument Health. Diversity and Minority Affairs reporting on SDPB is supported by Rapid City Rotary Club and the family of Dr. Ashok Kumar.
In the moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lori Walsh. In a few moments, we'll talk about the band Indigenous and the Black Hills Blues Society as we head West River. But right now, insects attack plants that are unhealthy. Let's talk about bugs and diseases today for our weekly episode of South Dakota Home Garden. Eric Helland is president and CEO of Landscape Garden Centers in Sioux Falls. You can send him a question in the moment at sdpb.org. He's with me here in the Kirby Family Studio. Hey, welcome back.
How are you?
Good. I've decided that every plant is a metaphor for people.
There you go.
Stress is bad.
Yes, yes. And there is actually some, it's kind of relative. I mean, you could kind of.
So a stress plant is vulnerable to all kinds of things.
Oh, right, right. So right now, most plants are being stressed because it is dry. They're looking for moisture. And so what we're going to see is you're going to see plants and actually, you're even seeing some corn in fields do this. It'll curl the leaves, right? Mm-hmm. So that's just to kind of protect it. Trees will lose some of their leaves. And then basically that's the time where pests, mostly insect pests, are become kind of prevalent. Diseases are usually more prevalent when there's a lot of moisture, humidity, and things to go along with that. But things to look for right now, we've heard they're getting quite a few cases of Japanese beetle. And that is a little bit bigger than a ladybug. and the opposite color, which would be green. So okay. It is a shiny green. It looks kind of pretty, but they will chew.
So that, what's the difference between that and an emerald ash borer? Because they're both green, right?
Right. So it's just the timing of the year.
Okay.
And so the emerald, the emerald ash borer will have, the larva is what's the damaging part. And then the insect that anybody would ever see would be what flies over and then lays the eggs.
Okay.
So there's different things that, and all insects, or most insects all have some type of life cycle. And so typically what we see as we're out in our garden is some, it's probably a later time than when they're really taking on the plant. So they're piercing and sucking insects, and there's the chewing insects, and that's a Japanese beetle will just completely just annihilate a tree and defoliate it.
Yeah.
Well, trees will come back from that, but in some cases they will, when it's already stressed, it's harder for that tree to come back. So there's Japanese beetle traps, and those are the best thing to use is the traps to collect the beetles and destroy them. Because what we don't want them to do is lay eggs, and then those come back the next year because that's part of their whole cycle.
By the time you see the beetle, is it too late?
Oh, depends. Just keep your eyes and ears open.
Okay.
Or not, probably not your ears. Not unless you really can hear chewing. Yeah.
So do people just bring in a leaf and with a bunch of holes in it and say, what is this? And can you tell the difference?
Oh, yeah. You can tell instantly. You can tell that. You can see where, take a picture. You can, mostly right now with the digital age, you can just take a snapshot, email it to us, and we can identify and even give you, okay, go get this. This should help. Or it might be a little bit behind the times. But then the other thing is when you notice this is when watering and fertilizing and all of those things and trying to keep those plants healthier helps out a lot.
Okay.
Spider mites are a big, big, big one right now. Tiny, tiny red, and they'll have a little webbing.
I've seen those.
Yes.
That's bad, huh?
Oh, they're not
little,
good.
Little tiny red guys, like little baby.
Right. But now here's the other thing.
Because I talked to them.
Do you?
Well, they're small.
They answer back.
I'm not going to tell you. I mean, no.
No. But the thing to remember about insects, they're all around us, and we're always going to have them. You can never eradicate them. We need them. That's part of the whole life cycle.
Sure.
It's just the amount of insects that you want in a certain area at a certain time.
What are the spider mites after? Why have I seen them in my backyard? Not a lot. I've seen.
Well, they're just all over. But what they'll do is they'll evergreens are being attacked by spider mites, and that's where you just need to spray. You've got to be careful with the spraying right now when it's this hot because you can also burn foliage. I talked about through the TV program that we're doing with you guys is, systemic drenches. Those are really good. Those help out a lot. And that's basically taking an insecticide, mixing it with water, and then giving the plant a drink, and then the plant actually takes it up, and that helps fend off those insects. So it's very similar to, getting back to your very first point, is that plants are like people. It's exactly right.
Yeah. You got to take care of it all the time. That self-care, you just can't put it off because stay healthy is easier than getting healthy when you're sick.
Right.
Ladybugs, good bugs, good pests to have.
Yeah. So ladybugs, I always say ants are good to have. I mean, because they're, and then there's other types of insects and insects that are always just foraging for dead and decaying material. So those are good. But people don't like insects when they're where they're not supposed to be.
Right.
In a house, in a garage, in a basement. Mm-hmm. So perimeter pest control is very, very popular, very, very simple. You can do it yourself. But then a lot of the other insects that are around and about in your mulch, in your planting beds, in the lawn, those are typically beneficial.
So clean up the detritus in your front lawn from,
Keep it away from the house, maybe.
Okay.
I mean, it's not completely bad, but it's, But good insects, yes. I mean, there's a lot of things. And some insects would be good for a certain period of their life. You know, I mean.
You said wasps have a benefit. And I'm not quite buying that.
This is going to give you the willies.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so these wasps will go and they will attack a cicada, which is the thing that goes bzzz, bzzz, bzzz. Uh-huh. We haven't heard them yet. But they'll attack them and they'll lay an egg inside the live cicada.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cicada will try to survive as long as possible, or the wasp will actually take it down into its den. The big B-1 bomber wasps that are about the size of, I don't know, about 1 to 2 inches long.
Yeah.
They'll actually hook onto them, and then they'll basically fly them into their nest, lay the egg, and then that way when the egg hatches, it has food. And then the cicada is, I mean, it's dead, but it has food. Parasitic. It's called a parasite.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're just about, did you eat lunch now or later?
No, I'm trying to stretch for a human analogy without.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Better, that's Star Trek.
So the wasps, you, yes, no to the wasp? Get rid of the, same thing. Well, okay. It depends on where they're at.
Right. So yeah. If they're right by a front door where you're going in and out.
Yeah, I've had
then
that.
Made, for sure, yes.
They had to go. And I'm a gentle right. person, but I drew right. the line.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's places. Bees, of course, are completely. Yeah. You always want to leave them alone. If you all of a sudden see a hive or whatever, there's a lot of places people will come in and help you remove them and or extinguish them just so that way we're not eradicating yeah. them.
All right. Well, you can send your emails to Eric and he will ask them. Otherwise, you know, it's just me asking about wasps. So,
there you go.
Which is also pretty good. I'm not going to lie. All right. So we're going to talk for a few ways about you can be part of the gardening and growing community. You can tune on Thursdays. Here, where Eric Helland will answer your questions. You can send us an email in the moment at sdpb.org. Anytime, we'll get your questions in queue. You can also join other South Dakota gardeners on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Use the hashtag SDHomeGarden. New segments of the digital series, highly recommended, posted every week at sdpb.org/SDHomeGarden. And those segments are also broadcast on SDPB TV 1 all the way through September 12th, and those are throughout the weekend. Eric Helland, thanks.
Yeah, have a happy 4th of July.
Happy 4th of July. Like many other arts organizations, the Black Hills Blues Society is trying to return to a little bit of normal, and they're going to do that in a big way later tonight as they present Indigenous at the Performing Arts Center in Rapid City. Born on the Yankton Sioux Reservation, Indigenous Mato Nanji has fronted the amazing blues band since 1998, and Mato joins us on the phone now. Hey, welcome back.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Here. Deb Lux is president of the Black Hills Blues Society, and she is joining us in the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio inside SDPB's Black Hills studio. Hey, Deb, welcome back as well.
Hey, nice to talk to you again.
All right, Deb, I want to start with you a little bit to talk about this event. What do you want to lay out for us here?
Well, it's been a long, tough year and a half, and I'm just really excited that live music is able to come back, and really excited that our first show of our return is with Indigenous and Mato, and in the historical Performing Arts Theater over on Columbus Street. So we're hitting three big marks there.
Yeah, exactly. Mato, how has the pandemic been for you as an artist and been for the band?
It's been pretty slow, actually, and it feels good to be a part of the whole show and, you know, be able to get back out there and do it again. You know, we've probably only done about one or two shows over the past year and a half. So.
Wow.
So it feels good to get back out there, and we're glad to be a part of this one.
Yeah. Have you been able to find a creative process for new material, or has it been just enduring the limitations of the time that we live in?
I've been kind of been writing and working on new stuff, so hopefully, you know, be able to get back in the studio and get something out within the next year or so.
That'd be pretty pretty exciting. Deb, tell us a little bit about what else the Blues Society has going on, because this isn't the only performance coming up.
Right. Next Thursday, we have a little mini-series going on. And next Thursday, on the 8th, we will also be bringing Tab Benoit back from Louisiana. He has a kind of swamp Delta blues kind of vibe, really great guitar player. And he has Alistair Green with him, who was the guitar player for the Alan Parsons Project, as well as Mickey Thomas's Starship, for all us old-timers, remember those days. fabulous. The two of them together, Tab and Alistair, will put on a great show. And the show tonight, we also have a local group opening with Waylon Mendoza and Johnny Hastings, the two guitar players, and also Caleb Britton, Garrett Holtz, and Will Waller will be backing them up, too. So it's going to be a fun night with a lot of great music, and I hope people come out. We still have good seats available. The theater is acoustically live, so any seat in the house is a great seat. Mm. And please come out, buy some tickets, support live music and the Black Hills Blues Society.
Yeah, Deb, tell us about Indigenous and Mato and the reason why this is such a big show for people who might be new to the region. They need to check this out.
Yeah, they sure do. As Mato mentioned, or I think you mentioned, they started out in 1998 as a very young, wonderful family group of dynamic musicians. And we had them here at our Jazz and Blues Festival in the park, in Memorial Park. I'm not sure what year it was, but it was right probably the end of 90, maybe 99, maybe 2000. And what's another exciting thing about tonight's show is Mato has his son with him who's going to be playing guitar with him. So carrying on the family tradition. And just really excited about getting to have Indigenous back in Rapid City and the Black Hills.
Yeah. Mato, tell us a little bit about how you think of music differently now, especially when you see your son taking up his own musical future.
Yeah, it's actually really, it's really something special, I think, because I've never really, like, told him to play guitar. He just picked it up on his own and started doing it. Next thing you know, he's playing all kinds of stuff, so I was just like, well, you should just come play with me. So he's been on the road just starting actually this year, so this is probably only like his probably sixth or seventh show that he's played with us, so it's pretty exciting, pretty inspiring, I guess, for me to, you know.
Yeah.
The older I get, it makes me want to keep going, I guess.
and you have inspired so many young musicians. I think it's fitting that you get to see that close to you on stage and close to you and your family as well.
Cool. Absolutely. You know, Waylon Mendoza, the guitar player tonight, the local one, he thinks of as you, Mato, as his mentor, his inspiration.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Mm. Awesome.
Yeah, so he's excited to meet you.
So many things. It's been nice to hear from everybody today. We're going to wrap things up. We'll put some links up on our show notes page at sdpb.org/news. Mato Nanji, thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Deb Lux with the Black Hills Blues Society, thank you as well.
Thank you. Tickets are available at performingartsrc.org. Please buy tickets.
That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. Thanks to all our guests and to SDPB Seth Tupper and Jordan Henderson and Susan Hansen for their assistance with today's program. For Steve Zwemke, Chris Loffrey, Josh Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.